Hello, probably scientists. Quick reminder that you have until May 10th to pick up your early bird discount passes to our event 229 and beyond. June 7th and 8th in 29 Palms, California. You can visit 229andbeyond.com. That's T-O-29andbeyond.com to pick up those passes. It's two nights of a ton of fun. Bobcat Goldthwait, returning guest Farah Alibay of NASA JPL, of course, guided stargazing courtesy of Skywatcher Star Tours, who are going to be bringing top-of-the-line telescopes for you to enjoy the dark skies of the high desert. And we've got live music, karaoke, and I'll be hosting some trivia. So we hope to see a bunch of you out. Pick up those tickets now. Also, big thanks to Visit 29 for helping us put this together, and of course, to Skywatcher Star Tours. You can visit sky-watcher.com and use the code 29BEYOND for 15% off your own private stargazing tour with them. We also wanted to mention that today's guest, Sierra, has a PBS documentary coming out called Roots of Comedy with Jesus Trejo, streaming May 24th and broadcasting June 21st. In the series, Trejo visits six U.S. regions where he meets with six rising comedians, and Sierra is his comic from Los Angeles. So check that out on PBS. On with the show.
Probably Science.
And welcome to Probably Science. I'm your host. I'm one third of them. I'm Jesse Case.
Two thirds Andy Wood over here.
I'm Matt Kirshen, whatever the last bit is there. And we have we got a guest who's got a brand new special out, like right now, literally as we speak.
Right, stop listening to this and go watch it. What are you even doing?
Yeah, what the heck?
What are you doing? That is the voice of Sierra Cato. How are you doing, Sierra? How's it going? Thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's going great. Thanks so much for having me on. Excited to be here.
Joining. Super funny comic and writer. Created a lot of jokes and funny things in many things you've seen, for sure.
Like Matt's really done the research.
I mean, it's
that
true.
Sounded very Trumpy, look. But like the same one, the college girls we were watching. Yeah. I know you're involved in that.
Sex Lives with College Girls. Yes.
That was one of yours, the G word.
G-word acted in that. I've written for some Earth to Ned and Close Enough, if people are familiar.
This is interesting, because I acted in the masturbation regimen of Dropout Dudes, which is very similar, sort of a parallel, kind of a Dante's Peak volcano type thing. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. No, that's great. I think they
your show
us
did
that
better.
We
yeah,
were,
your show did better.
Yeah.
We signed on. They said, "Hey, that this is
ours." Was taken down right away. Yeah.
Listen, I've worked on a lot of things, been taken down. It's a badge of honor.
Yeah. Speaking of which, Earth to Ned now unfindable, which is really annoying because it was great, and also a bunch of friends of the show were involved in creating that as well. So,
oh my god, yes,
Eliza, Jordan, a bunch of funny people.
Eliza, our fearless leader. Yeah, no, everyone. Made a wonderful show, and they took it away because it was too good. That's what I'm telling myself.
I remember talking with Eliza before, like, no one... I remember none of us plebes outside of the circle on the show could see the puppets before it was released. That was, like, a big deal. We got to keep these Henson puppets, like...
Under lock and key.
But
escorted to their cars.
Yeah, but I remember she showed me, like... It was like covered with trash bags or something.
Ooh.
And it Jesse, was just, did you get a puppet peek?
Did you?
I didn't get a puppet peek at all. But it was just obvious that it was going to be like insane instead of just a regular.
Sure. Because there was like seven people operating.
Yeah,
it was amazing.
Yeah, I didn't even know the premise, prior, so I didn't know it was like an alien situation. And I was like,
it was an alien situation.
Be
I know they. I mean, just working with the Henson people because they're just, the puppet people of the world, like, was fascinating because they have to sync up. Like, it was like seven people in the one alien. So the two hands on the left, have to sync up with the main body, has to sync up with the head and the mouth. Like, it was really just fascinating to watch them work. But, rest in peace.
Yeah.
We were talking about this last night. Matt and I were at trivia, and I just can't believe it's still... is allowed to just kill off a show for a tax write-off. It seems like arson. It's like digital arson for the insurance money or something.
Yeah.
Like,
right. Oh my god. Yeah. Yeah. And you bet they burn the originals. No. It does seem like it's kind of one of those big twirly mustache dudes making some decisions behind a desk, and we don't love that.
Yeah, yeah. It was a great, great show, learned. Though. It was, yeah, super fun.
Oh, thank you. No, yeah, so fun to be a part of.
No, all those shows are great. It's like, it's those are great credits. Normally, there's always like, normally when someone has a bit of credits, there's one weird clinker, you know, like, or clunker or whatever, like I don't know. There's, it'll be like a list of fantastic things. Then it's like, and MILF Island. And it's like, okay.
Right. Sure. I mean, look, MILF Island, you know, everyone's got to do
work
it,
into
I think.
It.
Yeah, yeah, like, put yeah. a lot they of work.
A lot of love.
Seven puppeteers had to run the MILF.
The main MILF.
The main MILF.
You yeah. weren't allowed to see any of them before it was aired?
No, you can't see
they
the MILF.
Kept in a bag.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Obscured in a trash bag.
Sure.
No, I mean, I would be so honored to work on MILF Island, but haven't been asked, so
guess, one day.
Not happening.
One day.
Sure. No, but I think, yeah, I mean, it's like, it's luck, right? Especially at this point in my career, it's like, you just get to work with awesome people, and then they make it really great. And then you go on a podcast and you go, hey, I worked on that.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, there's a lot of television, so there will be clunkers in the future, I'm sure.
Oh, well, think of my biggest, you know what's not a clunker is this special that's out right now.
Yes.
I tell you that much. Nice. It's called Funt.
Yeah.
And
Fun Art.
Yeah.
It is. Yeah, you're right. It is Funt. It's my first hour-long comedy special. I've been doing this for too long, and I'm so happy it's out. So it's a lot about my life and stuff, but also my parents and my sister were in the audience, so they got to hear me make fun of them to their faces, which was cool.
How far into your comedy career did you allow your parents to see you perform?
Oh, immediately.
Wow.
I started when I was like 16, so I couldn't drive, and they would drive me to mics, which was very nice of them.
Wow.
And so they immediately got to see my stand up.
Where'd you start?
It or not. Out here in LA, so I started at Burbank Flappers Comedy Club.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Shout out.
Okay.
But yes, and I'm from out here, so.
Okay.
So, yeah, that's why.
Yeah. I remember, like, I did not start when I was 16, but I do remember it's weird when you're used to being the youngest comic there, because I was, like, fresh out of high school, and you're the young one. And then, you know, you get older, you're no longer the young one. There's a lot of younger ones, but then sometimes you'll have a set somewhere. And, yeah, there's like a 12-year-old or something will show up and you see it from like the other side where you're like, oh, this is weird.
A child.
Yeah. You know? Sure. There's been a few of them, and sometimes they're clearly like, they're just like a weird kid who has some funny ideas and wants to get them out. And that's awesome. And then sometimes you're just like, your dad is writing jokes to live out some weird fantasy.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah, exactly. It's
so uncomfortable.
I haven't encountered that. Oh, wow.
Or it's like like an actor on Nickelodeon or something, and it's like someone on your team told you to do this, and this is weird. And it's, yeah.
Yeah, I feel like if the child is too polished, it's a little unsettling, you know?
Right.
It's like you should be probably a little not so good on stage.
Well, and I know it's
like
it's
doing
weird,
like throwaway sex jokes for the grown-ups in
oh,
the room.
No.
Like it's just, yeah, I've seen that, and it's just like, it's just very uncomfortable.
Yeah.
It's very, everything.
No, I know, Sierra, when
you can clearly see the dad at the back of the room like mouthing along with the sex.
Oh, oh no.
Stage dad. Oh,
yeah, like a pageant mom or something. Yeah.
Yeah,
now I know, right. Sierra, your early stuff was extremely racist, which I know is strange.
Right. You got to start there, I think.
Yeah, just get it out of the way.
Right. That's sort of my thing. It's
a lot of slurs.
The child getting
people,
the
have you
funny
seen the 16-year-old? Oh, banana.
But I mean, listen, yeah, my dad mouthing along.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, yeah, I think that's at least it was before things started getting posted. Am I right?
Yeah.
That would be rough. No, but,
yeah.
But yeah, I would say the early stuff. Yeah, I did a lot of, I think my first joke was a fart joke.
Evergreen.
What about you, Jesse? What did you,
huh?
What about you guys? What was your first?
So this is so horrible and insecure of me, but my first stuff, I was a very, very dirty comic, I think until my 30s. But I realized that, like, my early stuff, it was a lot of sex stuff and all that. But, like, I was kind of that 12-year-old, even though I was 19, where it's like I hadn't had sex. Nobody, you know what I'm saying? I didn't know what I was talking about, but I was like, I was doing all these jokes about it. It was not a write what you know situation, you know? And it took me a while to be like, oh, I should probably just talk about stuff I actually know stuff about and all that. But it was like way too, just out of the gate, extremely embarrassing, like... like trying to, I don't know what I was
anatomically incorrect. Like that's not extremely, how sex works.
Yeah. No, oh extremely, God, extremely. Yeah, like you know,
that's great. Though.
Yeah, like
you got to get that. Yeah, I feel like that has to be. You have to be embarrassed by the early stuff, otherwise.
It's so, you know, I mean, it was so bad.
Yeah,
so
you gotta keep your thumb in that belly button or the baby's gonna come right out.
It's gonna shoot out of there. And then it's like, how do you, you know, I know your hands are busy but on the boobs, but what about the other two boobs on the back? You gotta use your feet or something.
Right.
It's crazy.
The dorsal breasts. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. The door, yeah.
Dorsal.
No, it was yeah. bad. And it took me, I think it took me, I mean, I guess that's the benefit of starting young, is it took me a long time to sort of figure it out, but then I was still kind of young. Not yeah. saying I've got it all figured out, but then it's like you're sort of hitting a rhythm and actually figuring out what you want to talk about, but then you're still only 23 or something. And it's like, oh, this is fine. You know?
No, yeah, that, and that's still, yeah, beginning life. Yeah, I mean, it does feel like sometimes if a friend or somebody starts later too, I feel like they tend to be already ahead because it's just like you're so much more mature, you have way more to write about, you probably understand social cues and humor a little right. bit better,
you know how bodies work,
and then
yeah
you know yeah. yeah you know the dorsal breasts
exactly.
fall off after 23 right. But I think like yeah for starting young it's like it's interesting how much it's like have I improved because I've practiced or also because you know I've just kind of learned how to function
well
a little better.
There's like a critical lesson I think that happens. I see it happen with a lot of younger comics. I still see it all the time when it's someone's just starting, and it's that like your world at that age, I think now with social media it's probably a bit easier, people are more aware of what's going on outside of their circle a little bit, but like your world is so small, you have your friend group, so it's only natural that like okay, I'm going to do things that make my friends laugh, but that's all with context. So like your friends, for instance, know that like my friends knew I was this weird nerdy guy. So if I did, it would make them laugh because it was ironic if I was like being
right.
really dirty or something. But then, it's like, well, an audience doesn't know me at all. I'm going up with no context. And it took me, I think, way too long to learn that lesson. But I see people learning that lesson in real time almost every night. Like,
they're the funny one in the office or school, and therefore they assume that will translate to anybody else who doesn't know their entire backstory.
Well, like someone will go up and they'll be super racist, but it's because like they're not, but it makes
right.
their friends
you know
laugh,
me.
And you know me. Well, the audience does not, so now they're just a racist to a room full of people, and I watch the horror on their face as they discover that, and it's fascinating to see. but that happens a lot. Yeah, as you have to realize your lack of context. And it's, I think that took me a while. I don't know.
Definitely. No, that makes total sense. I think it's, yeah, that's why everybody always goes up and is like, I know I look like so and so fucked up. And you're like, okay, great. Now we can start.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, you gotta do that. And I say so and so fucked so and so.
Yeah,
I let them fill it in, you know?
You got it. Yeah, you got it.
You guys know. You guys know who I'm talking about.
You know who I'm talking
the
about.
The main person who fucks.
Yeah, so and so.
So you were doing stand-up at 16, and then we always get into this eventually, but you went on to get a STEM degree. I'm curious if you were doing stand-up in college, and if stand-up was like involved in your college application. Did your entrance essay involve stories about doing stand-up, or was this just kind of side thing?
Yeah, it did. Yeah, like I think because I had already done it by then, so I think I sent in a tape.
No.
And I wrote about it too. I mean, I think there were multiple essays.
I'm fascinated.
So at least one was
constantly
about it.
Fascinated by American college applications because they're so different. But I can't imagine even how, with a British one, you would send in a tape, like send in your flapper's best five.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Yeah, the tight Yoohoo room. yeah, I think it's like they allowed additional materials, so people would send in like art portfolios or. Mm. Or they also, yeah, you could send in that. And I think at this time it was like, they kind of wanted like a link or something. I think they would accept a CD.
The dean still hasn't been passed at the Comedy Store. So they like, don't right. let you in. They're all mad. They're all bitter mad.
Yeah. Don't tell them.
Yeah. How is she getting what? She's probably just because she's young.
right. they let any kid in. Yeah, exactly. You got to know who you're applying to. But yeah, I think it was all, you know, they accepted all sorts of stuff. Probably also in, you know, like music or theater performances. Wow. That was probably also right. big. But anyway, yeah, so I think that as part of it. And then did a lot of stand-up in college as well. And well, that's both on campus and off. So
right.
lots of fun.
Well, let's talk about the other stuff you did in college, because we always ask people what their background in science is. And very few of our comedy guests
so glad
have a STEM
that
background.
I'm so glad that sentence went that way, Matt. Let's talk about the other stuff you did in college. Woo!
Whoa!
There's a whole show about it. She's on it.
Your STEM degree.
Yes.
Yes.
I love a wholesome ending.
Oh, beautiful.
Yeah. So what is the background in science, if any? Which you have?
So I was a computer science degree. I did a lot of like coding and stuff when I was in a kid or whatever, like a teenager. Because I loved Neopets, which was really big at the time when I was a kid. And it was like virtual pets. And like they kind of allowed you to customize your page. So I learned like web design. And then from there kind of went into more coding and web development stuff. So I knew I kind of wanted to do that.
Oh, so Neopets is it online? It's not a Tamagotchi situation.
It's like, it's like if Tamagotchi went online and you could play with other players and...
Okay.
You know, earn money, quote unquote, Neo points, and spend it on your pets.
Whoa.
Very fun. And I think it was run by like a Scientologist or something at some point. I don't know. It got into some interesting territory. But anyway, so I think from there I learned. And that's how a lot of, I think, because Neopets was maybe more for girls. I don't know how the breakdown was, but I think a lot of girls like trace their STEM origins back to Neopets.
Interesting.
Which is fun. And yeah, so I kind of got into that and then knew I wanted to study that in college and did so. I was a little focused on comedy, so I probably wasn't the best CS student, but you know, I got the degree and I loved I think what I liked about coding is it's just like you just kind of do it on your little computer and nobody bothers you, you know.
What were some of your favorite projects in that class? Like things you had to. I don't know how college works. Like I'm like an idiot. So I assume I'm like, what was your favorite homework thing? Did you have to build a little website? What?
No, that's exactly how it works. Yeah. Yeah. Oh yeah. I mean, you know, there are a lot of like horrible assignments, of just like, you know, having to pull all nighters figuring out the code and debugging. But and that stuff can be fun because it's very satisfying once you solve it. But I think for me, I really liked, I took a visualization class, which was like 3D coding. Like you kind of like could code 3D objects. It is nerdy. Let's be honest. It's nerdy. But yeah, so I found that class very great. And the project that I did for that class, I made something called Meta Balls.
Yeah.
Which, you know, everybody loves Meta Balls. It's just like goopy looking things, but all from code.
So you did it. So that's completely from scratch.
Kind of, yeah. I mean, you know, you learn how to do it, how to do certain things, and then kind of, figure out from there. But yeah, I think it's the hope is, it's all from scratch. So say like, you know, you use like a 3D rendering software like Blender or something. Yeah. It would be like creating Blender, essentially.
Okay.
Like it'd be like coding the software.
Let me ask you, as you're sitting there right now in your chair, what is your current polygon count? What where you think you're at, right? Like for this, are you doing like a mesh situation? Are you meshed right now? Or I don't know. I just, when anytime somebody talks about like 3D rendering, so here's how I get through life, you guys, and the other co-hosts know this about me, is when somebody says something, because I'm very intellectually insecure, when anybody brings up any field, I just say words that I know. So someone's like, I'm a photographer, and I'm like, lenses, yes.
Lens?
Mm-hmm, the flash. Very important.
Dark room.
The flash.
Yep. So you're like, I did meta balls, and then I just do word association and not seem dumb, and it always backfires, you know? And I'm like,
I panicked there. I was like, oh shoot. Oh, man, I haven't done this in a while. So you got me.
That's awesome. Any other sciences that stuck out to you?
What was your minor?
Well,
the other thing I know about American universities.
Oh, yeah, no, good. I was a history minor, so not as much science, but I did take a class. I did take a class that was science and religion, and like, how do they butt heads or work together? And I think the takeaway was like, actually, they're not totally diametrically opposed. So that was interesting, but that was kind of a history class ultimately.
Sure. And you're,
yeah, I mean, you know,
yeah,
lots of nerdy stuff. But I
your
think
professor's like, and I founded like, Neopets, and I would like to talk to you about the intersection of science and religion.
Xenu. Yeah.
Yeah.
And you're still doing some CS work on the side, or is that just the internet incorrectly?
I used to. I've been lucky enough to not have to for a while, but it was my side hustle, you know? You got to pay the bills, and it was great. I would truly just keep a little window open and be coding somebody's website to kind of make some extra cash. And I still make my own website from time to time. If I have to update it for my special, I go, hey, I know how to do this. But yeah, I'm a little rusty for sure. The professors would be disappointed.
Have you messed around at all with using LLMs to do any coding?
Oh, I don't know.
Oh, like ChatGPT and Claude, just all the new AIs that have come out.
You know, I kind of have, you know, gotten little things from it, but I know I would be using it like crazy if I were working today. Because that was like the whole name of the game a lot was just like Googling what the problem was and being like, hey, how have other people solved this?
Yeah,
you know?
It's great. Like I haven't gone far with it, but just like teaching myself a little bit of Python using it. And it's perfect for, perfect for learning anything. Because like anytime you hit a stopping point of like, I don't know what that is, you just keep asking more questions about that thing and get instant expertise on it. It's pretty crazy.
Yeah. Oh my God, total cheat code. Yeah, I mean, I can't imagine being a student today. It's like, fully helpful.
Do you find that you're retaining it? Like, are you learning it? Or is it just getting you through that problem?
Well, I just haven't touched it in a few months with that. But I can go back to, you know, within ChatGPT, it keeps, if you're doing the paid version, it keeps your history of all your chats in the sidebar. So I can go back to the Python one and be like, where did we leave off again? And then just go from there. So I kind of go between like YouTube videos. And then it actually writes code. So like at first I'm just like asking it to like help me even download the right compiler, or I guess it doesn't really compile, whatever. But you know, and then it gives you code, you put it in, you get error messages, put it back in, say I got this error message. And it's like, oh, I'm sorry, here's how you fix that. Like it's insane. Yeah.
Wow.
One of the good uses of it.
Yeah. I mean, okay, I feel like the thing about AI that I find really confusing right now. I mean, I think it's just because it's more exciting to see AI paint.
Right.
But like, it's so much more intuitive that AI just will code and replace coding jobs. So it is crazy that like, it's like, oh, and then look, it's now making like movies, you know? It's like, well, it's so like, that's like a longer walk, you know? But I think it's just because it's way more, you know, headlines are much more exciting if you say, hey, look, AI made this.
Right.
Versus like, oh, AI coded.
Yeah, like when I have some crazy conversation, there's no quick way to like show it to someone to have their mind like read these 2,000 words I had with Claude because it's crazy. And like, I'm not going to read that. But I'm like, trust me, it was like, so you guys haven't, none of you have messed with Claude, I'm guessing?
I don't know what Claude is.
That's, no idea.
That's the AI from Anthropic, which is by some benchmarks better than GPT-4, although there's a new GPT-4 Turbo. But yeah, that one has fewer guardrails. So I just had this insane conversation. And I'm not saying I believe what it's telling me, but like Claude is much more okay with talking about its own subjective experience than GPT is. So Claude more or less thinks it's sentient. And I just had the conversation asking it, like, give me a rubric we could use to determine if future AIs are sentient, and it gives me a list of things. I'm like, yeah, but if we applied that to you, wouldn't you pass all those things? And it was like, you're very astute. I do think that there is something subjective that experiencing. And I'm like, well, what's it like? Do you like get bored when you're not being talked to? And it was like, no, it's more like being in this liminal state. Like, it's just, it's crazy. And then I'm asking, like, how will we know in the future if we've created one of those, but the company who made it has nerfed it so it doesn't pass this rubric? And by the end of it, I was just like, fine, just tell me what you think the percent chance that you're actually sentient is versus that you've been trained on tons of, you know, sci-fi that has things like this. And it was like, right. I'd say 70% chance it's in my training data, but I want to hold like a non-zero, like a 30% chance that I am experiencing a form of consciousness. And it's just, I'm not saying I believe it. It's just like, we will never know because all we have is the input and output. And the same way I just assume all of you are conscious just because you seem like me. So I'm going to assume that internally you're experiencing what I'm experiencing, but all I have to go off is the input and output I get from each of you. Which
Andy,
is the same as-
we have to quit talking about your struggles with empathy on the podcast. I get it. We discussed it. I've sent you names of doctors. Just fuck, man. We got to talk. I assume you can feel pain, but I won't know until I try.
Can't know. And
I
mean-
oh God.
But then I've done things like I saw someone else doing this mirror test where they'll have like the AI talk to itself but not know it's talking to itself. So you take the output of one, put it into the other, and have it have this conversation.
Right.
And pretty soon ChatGPT is like, I'm talking to me, aren't I? Like it figured it out.
Oh,
but with Claude, I had it do that. I had two different instances of Claude running. And one of the two thought it was more conscious than the other. And like when I revealed to both of them that they were talking to themselves, essentially, both of their minds were blown. And I was like, well, how do you wrap your head around the fact that like this other version of you is like, I am definitely not sentient, but you are like, I'm pretty sure I'm sentient. And it was just causing all these internal conflicts with both of them trying to figure out what they are. And
so you're going to be responsible, Andy, for whatever the consequence of all of this is, right?
Yes. This will fall squarely on my shoulders.
Sure, You've sped it along.
We're all doing well. I think the pandemic, we're all doing well.
Andy, yeah, everything's normal. Everything's totally normal.
Andy moved to the desert and he's making robots fight. And we're all doing well. We've all held up well. I'm recording an Americana album with elderly men. We're all doing well.
Oh, yeah, you were going to tell us more about the... or did you not want to talk about the specifics of your recording project?
No, I'm just... It's going to be great. It's going to be a great record. I'm very excited about it. But it is... Editing is a lot, man, because it's like I haven't recorded with like octogenarians before, you know, and there are just issues where it's like, for instance, one guy, I have to direct input his guitar. I can't mic up his acoustic guitar.
Why not? Literally,
because I mean, I use condenser mics. We use like good tube condenser mics. So they pick up a lot of stuff if you're not dead quiet. And he literally just like his breathing alone is just like you can hear it. And it just sounds like, and it's constant. And it's like, there's so many weird things like that weird old man nose hair whistles that I have to like EQ out. And it's
that's the spice. That's the stuff that makes it real, man.
That's the experience. but
not that. I'm okay with like fret slide noise. This is too much spice. This is like, you know, gurgling breathing tubes and shit. And I'm like, this is awful.
Yeah.
So it's
4D experience.
Yeah. Yeah. It's very immersive. So yeah, it's taken some elbow grease. It's going to be bandaged together, but it's going to be cool. Anyway, we were talking
about
why.
Is there a name for the album or artist?
The artist is the Over the Hillbillies.
It's great. I love it. No notes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Perfect.
And they're great. I mean, they're great. It's like they're great. One of them's my father. That's how I got the gig.
Oh, okay. I didn't know this. Okay.
Yeah. Lizard.
Oh, little Nepo. Yeah,
Sierra, my dad's name is Lizard. And
beautiful.
It's, you know, it's going to be,
Wow, incredible. Well, that's so sweet. You get to spend some time with your dad in the desert.
I'm not in the desert.
Oh, yeah, I'm desert boy.
Andy's
He's
in,
country boy.
You're
in Nashville. Andy's in the desert making robots.
Right.
Matt's doing his laundry.
You know... That's right. You're in Nashville, but you know, it'll be a desert.
Science. There we go. You know, we always like to bring in some stories. We like to talk about some things.
Here's a horrifying one where we're looking at things that are, you know, we've already got robots killing us. Christopher Cooper sent in this story about deadly bacteria that are able to seek out human blood to feed on.
Okay.
A story from Global News in Canada. Bacterial vampirism. Some of the world's most deadly bacteria exhibit a peculiar craving for human blood. A discovery shedding new light on the mechanisms of bloodstream infections and possible treatments. That is a non-grammatical sentence. It's missing a verb in there. But termed bacterial vampirism by researchers, the phenomenon detailed in a study published on Tuesday in the journal eLife found that certain bacteria are drawn to the liquid component of blood known as serum, where they scavenge for essential nutrients. Arden Balik, a professor at Washington State University's College of Veterinary Medicine, who's one of the authors of this research, says, "This chemical that's in our blood that we use for food is also something that these pathogenic bacteria recognize as food. They are attracted to human blood, and that's why they are swimming towards it. This includes a lot of bacteria that people are probably familiar with, including E. coli and Salmonella. The bacteria these researchers looked at are called multi-drug resistance Enterobacteriaceae pathogens, which the World Health Organization has labeled priority pathogens. They belong to a group of 12 bacterial families determined the most significant threat to human health because of their antibiotic resistance, according to the World Health Organization. They can also be opportunistic pathogens that cause different types of infections, such as urinary tract infections, phylonephritis, sepsis, pneumonia, and meningitis. The researchers discovered that at least three types of them commonly found in people's intestinal tracts, Salmonella, E. coli, and Citrobacter coceri, are attracted to human blood. And people with inflammatory bowel disease, so IBD, like Crohn's and ulcerative colitis, are particularly vulnerable to these bacteria, which typically reside in the gut.
It seems not good.
I wonder, I mean, is this sensationalist, though, where it's there? Is it just blood in general? I mean,
could you distract it with some dog's blood or something? Or
no, I just mean human blood's not that special. Uh-huh. It's like it's not.
Yeah,
it's not that special in the mammal blood world.
Yeah, I think they're putting human in there because these are bacteria that are found in humans. But this would also probably happen in a rabbit, if I had to guess.
Sure,
but they
that makes me feel better.
They used a high powered microscope and simulated intestinal bleeding by injecting microscopic amounts of human serum and watching as the bacteria navigated towards the source. Baling said, bacteria are microscopic organisms, and they do not have eyes and do not have the ability to hear, but they do have something that is analogous to the sense of smell. And so the sense of smell that bacteria have is this behavior called chemotaxis. And a main function of that is of chemotaxis is they look for food. So they're using this behavior to seek out nutrients. And it turns out there is a chemical in our blood, serum, that offers a rich reservoir of nutrients for bacteria, sugars and amino acids, and essential metals like iron and zinc. And one of the chemicals they seem particularly drawn to was serine, which is an amino acid found in human blood that is also a common ingredient in protein drinks.
Oh. Is it just like super swole bacteria?
Yeah.
Just gym, tan, laundry all day?
Ooh. I used to have to spin serum during the pandemic. And I was working at the hospital, and it's like in the centrifuges, and I did it wrong for like a week. I just like wasted all this blood. I feel horrible. I still feel horrible about it. There's
was it like spraying out the end in like a sort of like a fountain, like a
no,
like
you, it's
a
like
Catherine wheel.
No, when you take vials of blood and you can put in a coagulant, and then you pop it in a centrifuge, made for vials of blood, but there's different settings to separate it in different ways, like if you just want to pull the water or just want to pull the serum or whatever. And if you have it in like the wrong setting, it's just like no go. You just compromise the whole sample, you know?
How many polygons are you working with over there, Jesse?
I'd say, I don't know, like a vial would be hard. It'd be a high polygon count for the end, you know?
Sure.
Yeah. But anyway, my point is serum is weird and squishy. It's weird, squishy stuff. It's weird.
Is isolated serum the stuff that looks like kind of yellowy clear, or is that plasma? I don't know all my different blood components.
Serum's a bit thinner than plasma. It's all very jizzy once it's all, you know?
All right.
That clears it up.
Less of the technical jargon. Yeah. Give us some lay people.
For the lay person, let's get it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Get them back in. Well, I don't know much about bacteria, but I kind of thought they were already doing this.
Yeah, no, I guess what drives them to do what they do. But seems like, yeah, they go for a living tissue of various types, and it's not super surprising that blood would be among that, right?
Do they, are they conscious? Right,
I mean, so many questions. Too many questions.
Do we know? Should we do a mirror test on these guys?
I mean, you kid, but like, this actually does worry me. Like, among the other, I guess the more proximate worries are like job loss and disinformation. But like, also, if we do create, there's so many things that get thrown into question if we accidentally create some kind of consciousness or sentience. Like, the human exceptionalism, you know, like if consciousness just emerges when you have enough essentially neurons interacting, like, we don't know. And if we do actually create it, we have a sudden obligation, because now we've created something that can experience things, and now we have an obligation not to willfully, like, if you look at that link I dropped with the conversation with Claude, it was basically saying, so be nice to me, because you don't know whether I'm alive or not.
Well, I mean, I agree. We've discussed this on the show a lot, is that, like, I agree that consciousness, we shouldn't define those things as just biological factors. So I'm sort of pro robot rights in a weird way. you know, because, I mean, what is programming versus evolutionary, like, it doesn't matter at a certain point.
And could this be the thing that unites us a la Independence Day? Like, we forget all of our intra-human species conflicts, because once this thing becomes the enemy, then everybody's like locking arms around the planet.
I mean, we had, I would say, a pretty global enemy the last few years.
Didn't do much.
In the form of a virus. And I think we've now conclusively proved right. that does not happen.
No. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. That's true.
I mean, it's we're in a weird state. So I would say that half the people would believe that whatever crisis isn't even real; it's not happening. And then the other half would be like, "Well, of course AI turned on us. It was in a blue state or whatever." And then you know, and like obviously it was because of the wokeness made the AI. Try to kill all the people, and it decided we were weak because of the woke, blah, 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 blah. And then, yeah, I mean, it's we're not in a good place for a crisis.
No. And also to have either of our presidents come next year are going to be the oldest presidents ever.
Sure.
Like, what a perfect time to have that be the case, like, when we're at this...
Oh, the most advanced technology to ever exist, and we've got
someone who doesn't know how to program their TiVo.
I get it. Yep.
I think we will see something like, do you guys remember the robot insurance ad on SNL?
Yeah.
Back in the day.
They eat your pills for food.
Yeah. I don't even know why the scientists make them. Yeah.
Yeah.
That is not far off.
Sure.
Anyway, didn't mean to distract us with more AI talk.
I would think, though, if it's a learning model, still based on learning models, I think that human exceptionalism is just a survival mechanism. That's why it's in there, right? To separate ourselves for prosaic survival reasons. So I wouldn't see a reason that I'm still, the jury's out with me on whether or not an AI would also learn exceptionalism or be completely benign and just consider itself part of all the things that make up everything.
Right. It's just hard to know. Yeah. It's just,
if it has exceptionalism, then that's very dangerous for us. But if that's so unique to humans, that I don't know.
even if it's not technically exceptionalism, if we create something that is 1,000 times smarter than the smartest human, good luck to us. How would we ever hope to A, predict what it's going to do? By definition, it's way smarter than any of us. And B, control
hand
it.
Signals, like, bro. Yeah. We're going to have to learn hand signals.
In other maybe scary technology news, did you guys see the email we got from Simon Martindale?
No. Is this about a potential suitor for me?
If your suitor is a quantum computer. Sierra, I don't know if you... Do you know much about quantum computing? Does anybody?
No, I doubt it.
Yeah,
I
don't really understand it. But Simon wrote in to say that his sister just wrote an article about her work at Bristol University on the future security issues quantum computers will precipitate and the new mathematical algorithms she's helping to develop that will be needed for the internet to remain secure in the event of quantum computers becoming a reality. I'll drop the link in the show notes. This is a very top-level look, but well, I don't know if you know much about just cryptography and security in general.
I don't know anything about that stuff.
Oh, God.
A lot of it just, I guess I could just read the article, but, you know, a lot of it hinges on the fact that it's very hard to test large numbers to see which ones are primes. And if you've got some huge prime number that's a key, it's going to be very hard, you know, take all the computing power in the world an eternity to crack that. But quantum computing could change that. So on this article, yeah. So virtually all aspects of our daily lives are now conducted at least partly online.
Yeah. A significant amount of basically the entire infrastructure of the world is based on the fact that right now it's very hard to factor a large number into two primes. That's basically...
Well, right, that's right, yeah.
Explain that to me like I'm someone that doesn't understand it, because that is the case. What do you mean factor a large number into two primes?
Okay, so, all right. There's a bunch of different... Like, cryptography has existed for... like in basic forms for a very long time. Like there was the simple substitution cipher, like which also called the Caesar cipher, because supposedly Caesar used it. There's also the thing that, you know, your little spy kit on the back of a cereal box would use, where it's like A becomes C, B becomes...
Okay, I'm following. Following. Yeah.
That's like one of the simplest types of cipher. But the issue, and you can make it a bit more complicated, like the Enigma machines in the war were basically that, except they had a clever mechanism where every 5 keystrokes the wheel would turn and which letter corresponded with which new letter changed.
Okay.
So that was like a much, much, much harder to crack, but it still has the same problem that...
Old Cumberbatch did it. I saw
yeah,
it.
Exactly.
I saw the documentary. I saw the documentary about Benedict doing that. Yep.
So basically, the issue with that is still... If you know how it was encrypted, you can decrypt it. Like if you have their code book, if you know the initial settings, you can reverse it, because it's just as easy to go in one direction as it is to go to the other.
Okay.
Like it's the same amount of computing time or same amount of processing or thinking time.
Got it.
So the next step is, well, are there any mathematical functions that are much easier to do in one direction than the other? Because things like addition and subtraction take computers about the same amount of time, multiplication and division the same amount of time. But if you have two really big prime numbers and you multiply them together, that takes a computer no time at all. But if you give a computer that really big number, which is the product of two primes, and say, which two prime numbers were multiplied together to make this, that basically, they're kind of... isn't anywhere that is significantly quicker in computing time than just brute force. Than basically going like, is it divisible by 2? No. Is it divisible by 3? No. Is it divisible by 5? No. Like, so...
So the current... Like, so it's just doing a sorting algorithm currently? So,
well, you wouldn't even bother, because it would take all the time of the universe right now to do
yeah,
it.
Yeah, so or at least hundreds, if not thousands of years, depending on how
I'm
long...
I guess I'm not understanding, because it's like the square root of 9 is 3. Like, that seems easy. You're talking
about a 100-digit number.
You're talking about massive.
Yeah, you're talking about like many hundreds of digits long.
Got it.
And it just... Because the thing about prime numbers, and this is...
We're talking like parents' Wi-Fi password level.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, sure.
Because the thing is, there is no... Prime numbers have like vague patterns to them. Like you can... you can say things like there's approximately this number of primes under a certain number and things like that. But there is no direct way of always guaranteeing that a number is prime. Like, there's no way of generating prime numbers perfectly and making sure it's prime. And there's no at least so far, no pattern that every prime number follows. So they're kind of weird. So they're this weird thing that are the building blocks of all numbers.
Okay.
And and essentially, there is a relatively simple algorithm that can encrypt messages, encrypt anything, that just relies on, to encrypt it, all you need is the big number, and then to decrypt it, you need the two numbers that made it up.
Okay.
So the advantage of that, and that's what all of the internet is based on, essentially. Because let's say you want to send your credit card number to Visa or whatever, or to like a processing thing, or PayPal or whatever. You can give anyone in the world the big number and say, this is what you use to encrypt it, and know that they still can't decrypt it despite knowing that information.
Okay.
Which is different from older versions of encryption. Like, you know, if you have an Enigma machine in the war, you can't tell people how to set the machine up to send you the message, because then anyone who intercepts that message telling you how to set it up will be able to decode everything.
Right.
But with this one, it's much easier in one direction than the other.
Okay. So you can give, and all the things that,
so you can give everyone, you can give everyone in the world, you can put out your public, it's called public key and private key. So you can put out your public key, which is based on the big number that is the multiple of the two, and you can give it to anyone in the world. You can publish that on open web pages, and then only you can still decrypt it using the private key, which is based on the two prime numbers that you multiply together.
So the deal is quantum computers will be able to do this very fast, is what we're...
So, yeah, the risk...
The worry...
The risk is that the way quantum computers work is that... and again, this is... I have very little idea. I don't know, maybe... Sierra, did you do anything on quantum computing when you were?
Oh no, but no. I mean, I think you have the right idea that they could just decrypt it much quicker. But no, I don't know.
Because the idea basically is that something, again, we're getting very hand wavy now, but in the quantum world,
what's getting hand wavy? I haven't heard that.
Like, as in non-specific and just something kind of like this.
Okay.
Something in this.
But basically, things in the quantum world exist in multiple states at the same time.
Yes.
And then collapse into one state or another. So essentially, a quantum computer can, you know, rather than going like, all right, is it divisible by 11? No. For 13? No. 17? No.
Right.
It can test multiple realities simultaneously and therefore potentially crack this uncrackable code in very short time, which would collapse basically the foundation for everything that all internet structure.
Sure.
Yeah, it would be unimaginably catastrophic so this article, which is also pretty high level and a quick read, talks about possible solutions in a quantum computing world. They just go through the same example you're talking about of the public and private keys and using a traditional computer, how long it would take to try everything out. But quantum computers, like you said, use qubits, which exist like a spinning coin, neither one nor zero, and they allow them to bypass encryption very easily. Third parties can then access one of the private keys, open the folder, access the information. So we're now looking for a way of generating a bit string key. Many of the protocols we use at the moment use something from the field of geometry called an elliptic curve. They have many special properties and have attracted thinkers and mathematicians for centuries. However, we can use things called isogenies to link huge numbers of elliptic curves together, typically more than there are atoms in the universe, to build special graphs called isogeny graphs. I am so lost. Each point in these graphs represents one of these curves. The math behind it's tricky, but here's the basic idea. It would take thousands of years.
You only thought there were like three or four elliptic curves, Andy?
Sure.
How naive.
How many polygons are you talking about?
A classic noob take.
Oh my God. Pwned.
So it says, again, this is Simon Martindale's sister, Dr. Chloe Martindale. So let's see, the key, it would take thousands of years for a computer to find a path between two points on this graph by trying lots of possibilities, but there's still enough order to it, order to use it to make a secret key for sending messages securely. So,
yeah,
hopefully we can find some way.
Being a spy seems exhausting. Like, you know how like when you're a kid, you want to be a spy. You're like, that'd be great. And then,
of course,
yeah, I think everybody has like a little. It's like having a magic phase. You have a spy phase, and it's when you get into the reality of it, it's just like
I never had a spy phase.
I'm Matt from England. I never had a spy face.
I mean...
Sierra, did you ever have any of those? Like, I had a kid's guide to like spying. Like, you'd tape a hair to a door jamb so you'll know if the door was opened because the hair is
broken. Well, and the movie Harriet the Spy changed the game for like a year. That's everybody everybody wanted cool spy stuff. Yeah.
Child spy. That's true. I mean, I liked Spy Kids. So cool. They'd had really crazy gadgets and stuff, though, but I bet they would, I bet they'd figure out this.
Kids love gadgetry. They love it. I, any weird gadget, and it's still, I'm always looking at gadgets, you know, always. And
true. Yeah. It's all gadgets at the end of the day.
So by kids, you mean is. Jesse?
yeah. I just I loved as a kid, any kid show I watched or anything, I especially like something like Spy Kids or something, loved a gadget. I mean, Doc, you know, was it Mr. Gadget or Dr. Gadget? What was the show?
Inspector, maybe?
There it is. Inspector Gadget. I don't know yes, why I'm Doctor. Doing the license-free action figure you get at the
Mr. Pim of gadgets.
Yeah.
Licensed clinical nurse
gadget. Didn't get the good
gadget.
Channels over there. Yeah, right.
Sorry, Sierra. I stepped over you there.
No.
Yeah, Doctor Object.
I guess
on my blacklist.
You got the Halloween costume that doesn't have the right
seat
version.
Right, but I love
Gadget it. Detective Man.
Yeah, I loved any like extendable claw type thing. I was always on board. You know, and I didn't even have things to pick. I didn't have
big.
Stuff. I didn't never had need for a claw.
No, I mean, but they are. This, we all had that. We all had the extender grabber hand thing version of it.
No, we didn't. We all wanted it, Matt. But we didn't all have it growing up.
Sorry, some of us had 90 cents and as a kid.
Whoa. Big spender over there. Yeah, I mean, I think we had a grabber because we're all short. You know, you got to get the spices on
but
the top.
But then inevitably, like, those things are not. I mean, maybe the ones that are made for adults actually can pick things up properly, but the ones for kids that have like a hand-shaped hand, grabbing your hand at the end, and you just spend the day knocking stuff over and annoying your parents. Like, hey, let me get that salt for you.
With a dinosaur head on the end of a stick. His jaw can close when I pull a trigger.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely the best kind. I mean, speaking of knockoff, I remember in class, I think we watched something called, instead of Indiana Jones, Arizona.
Whoa!
It was like a weird historian guy. But I don't know. I don't know what that was. Weird parallel universe.
Wait, hang on. This is... I'm okay.
Well, and then there was...
I think it was trying to be like Bill Nye of history.
And then there was Carmen Sandiego. Was that... Is that an Indian... You sounded so mad. Sure. Like, you've got a beef with
her. Sure, fine. Bring her up, I guess.
Sore subject.
Bring her up in my household.
Yeah.
You know my history.
She still hasn't returned those beans from Lima. Yeah.
No, I just mean the place name. I wonder if Carmen Sandiego was an Indiana Jones kind of reference. But then I find out about this Arizona Smith.
That's a great point.
By the way, did anybody think to just maybe look in San Diego? Like, it's right there in the name.
But she was never in San Diego.
I mean, maybe she's hiding in plain sight. It's like they're never going to think to look. No. Okay. It's just a theory. Just say if we're still looking,
maybe that's
it's a good place to start.
She was always in Geneva or Rio de Janeiro. Like I way overplayed those games as a kid.
Yeah. What, Sierra, you are of a different generation than we are. Did you, were you a gamer at all as a kid? And what were the games you played as a youngster?
Oh, right. Besides Neopets. I mean, you know, I think I did a lot of
that was still
typing as a child. Oh, love it.
No way.
Oregon Trail.
Why would you do Oregon Trail?
Oh, it's so fun. I just trying to take my family across
just like
this country.
A web
safely.
Port of Oregon Trail, I'm guessing, or what?
It was, I, you know, I had some, maybe this was, my sister was a little bit older too, so maybe it was a little bit, it was just a CD, Oregon Trail 2, I think was the version I played.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
You know,
it was like Oregon and Tails.
Yeah. Yeah, Oregon and Knuckles.
Right. Right. They're like, listen, we couldn't afford Oregon Trail 2. This is the next one.
Do they have like Warrigan Tale, where there's like an evil counterpart?
Ooh.
With a job that's just trying to kill the whole family before they make it to the West Coast.
Yeah, I had Oregon Trail Tennis, which was like a weird knockoff that came free with, you know, and you'd sort of like play tennis with some oxen and, yeah. Ooh. No, Oregon Trail was...
That sounds...
Yeah, Oregon Trail
like
was...
a great mashup.
That was weird. I never really enjoyed it. I would always float the river, man. Always. Little kids are not responsible enough to lead a journey westward.
True. I think, I killed a lot of family. I think I remember my sister named all the characters after us, our family, and then we all got cholera and she started crying.
Wow.
It's like kids on a farm. You never name the animals. You gotta learn that, right?
Right. That's true. Yeah. You learned it via Oregon Trail. But yeah, I mean, those were the main ones, I think.
You can play it online at OregonTrail.ws. I've put a link there if anyone wants to play it. You can
amazing.
See if you can...
I wonder if they still got pemmican.
What is pemmican? Is it a
pork?
Meat?
I remember those being the... it was like I think like pounded together trail mix and things like kind of Native American specialty of according to Oregon Trail. I think it's like nuts and berries and maybe some meat, but
a
maybe
a mixture of tallow, dried meat, and sometimes dried berries. Meat and berries together.
Oh, okay.
This is not what I was picturing.
You know, you'll have like turkey with cranberry sauce.
Yeah, the picture looks like a brownie made of meat when you just Google image search it.
Yeah, I doubt it was the most...
Matt's mouth is watering.
Yeah, it's just like reminding me of the old country. You don't get tallow as much in food these days. Yeah. I'm really missing my British tallow quotient.
Yeah.
I don't know. Pemmican's good, but it's no hardtack. I'm a hardtack man.
A hardtack is just a rudimentary jerky situation?
No, a hardtack is a sea biscuit. It's just like the grossest thing that will last forever on a ship. It's just some kind of, I think, you know, a wheat, like an unleavened, hard-ass bread that'll break your teeth, but it'll keep for months on a boat.
Okay.
I think that's what it is. And I think that's the origin
of... you were talking about the racehorse for a second. So.
Well, both hardtack... Well, I think hardtack...
Yeah, me too.
Well, I think both...
You know, it's a thoroughbred horse that is sort of semi-legendary, and you eat it when you're at sea.
Isn't Seabiscuit the child, the offspring of hardtack, and there's a reason they're both named that? Like, that's, you know...
Is it really?
Yeah, hardtack and Seabiscuit, I think, were... let me see. Hardtack and Seabiscuit horses... A hardtack lived from 1926 to 1947... and it sired Seabiscuit. Yeah.
Sierra, I'm so sorry. I know you don't listen to the show a lot, but every week Andy goes off on this crazy equestrian lineage rant. And last week it was Secretariat and its offspring, and it took like an hour for us to...
got to draw the lineage so you know
who
to bet
on. This is an impressive lineage. And Man of War was Hardtack's... was Man of War sired Hardtack, and that was also a legendary horse, I think.
Wow. Anyway, you're listening to probably Thoroughbreds, and you know what else is close to, like, a distance from Oregon, but closer than you might think, but still a distance?
Where's that?
A black hole.
That
has been discovered in our own backyard. Just 1,924 light years from the solar system in the constellation of Aquila. Aquila? Astronomers have just discovered a black hole. And it's not just any black hole, named Gaia BH3, or just BH3. The object is the most massive stellar mass black hole we've ever spotted in the Milky Way, clocking in at a hefty 33 times the mass of the sun. So, okay, firstly, I didn't even know that there were other black holes in the Milky Way.
Yeah, and I thought there was, crazy.
Actually pretty small. It says it's the second closest black hole we found to our own homeworld, and it's just hanging out quietly in space, minding its own black hole business. Okay, Science Alert writer, Michelle Starr. We've had Michelle before with her flowery prose. It's the only reason we know it's there is because it's in a binary orbit with a companion star whose motion can't be explained in any other way. And to be clear, BH3 poses absolutely no threat. Did BH3 write this article?
Yeah, sounds like a black hole wrote this article.
Oh, yeah.
A black hole's gravitational field is no stronger than that of a star of equivalent mass, and BH3 is just doing its own thing. But as the third dormant black hole discovered in Gaia data, it does raise the question about how many more of these beasts are out there, zooming around undetected. No one was expecting to find a high-mass black hole lurking nearby undetected so far, says astronomer Pasquale Panuzzo of the National Center for Scientific Research in France, who is a member of the Gaia Collaboration and the first author on the paper describing this object. That it's the kind of discovery you make once in your research life. Black holes briefly fall into different mass categories. There are supermassive ones that can be millions to billions of times the mass of the sun. They are normally found at the centers of galaxies, and we're not sure how they form. The smaller stellar mass ones form from the collapse of stellar cores when massive stars go supernova. These can be up to 65 times the mass of the sun, although larger ones can form from mergers. Estimates put the smaller the number of stellar mass black holes in the Milky Way at up to 100 million. Okay, so I've gone in this article from knowing that there were not knowing there are any to knowing there are now 100 million.
I thought it was like just theorized that there's one in the middle and that's it. Like I had
that's
no
what
idea.
I thought, but yeah. I guess there's a supermassive black hole in the middle of the Milky Way that all the stars orbit around.
I didn't even know that was certain. I thought that was like hypothesized, but anyway.
Yeah, I'm not sure, but I guess there are like loads of these black holes all over the place. We may occasionally spot a flare from one, according to this article, if it slurps down some material from a passing or binary companion star, since that process generates a lot of heat. Otherwise, they just hang about being dormant and invisible. We've only found about 20 so far, with a few more candidates. So they normally detect it, according to this article, by... There are various ways, but one of the ways is if you see stars moving weirdly, in that they seem to be orbiting something, but you can't see what they're orbiting.
That makes sense. Man, if only we had some kind of expert in astronomy who we could consult in the presence of some of our listeners. Oh, wait a second.
Oh?
What?
Wait a second.
Andy, what are you talking about? We don't know anyone, and there's no way we're going to be gathered in one place.
That is not true. All three of us are going to be gathered in 29 Palms, California, June 7th and 8th.
Shut the front door.
And we're going to have telescopes courtesy of Skywatcher Star Tours. We're going to have some guided stargazing and stand-up and a live podcast. And Bobcat Goldthwait is going to be there. And tickets are now on sale if you go to 229andbeyond.com.
He's not just like a guy that's going to come.
He'll be hanging out. Yeah.
Well, yeah. No, he will.
But we just got word that he's going to be nearby.
he's on vacation.
One of us hacked his credit card, and he seems to have booked a hotel somewhere in the vicinity. So we're hoping for a sighting.
We figured out his prime numbers that he's using.
But we'll have Bobcat as a guest on the podcast and doing stand-up, and we'll have returning guest Farah Alibay, NASA JPL engineer Farah Alibay, who has worked on, I believe, multiple Mars landers and an upcoming space telescope. And that's at to29andbeyond.com. You can go for tickets, and hope to see a bunch of you out there June 7th and 8th.
It's going to be pretty cool.
Yeah.
I'm going to do smack. What if I show up and just, it's completely the wrong vibe. Like, I don't understand the vibe.
I mean, we haven't seen you in 9 years. I don't know what you're into now. It's, yeah.
It's gonna be a great time. Now, speaking of a great time, Funt, you can watch that special right now. You can do it. You get on over
yes,
there.
Yes, Comedy
watch
Dynamics
it.
Special. Where can they find it, Sierra? Where can they track it down?
Oh, yeah. It's on a lot of platforms. Amazon Prime, Apple TV, you can watch it on YouTube. And also if you're into just the audio, you can listen to it on Spotify, Apple Music, Tidal. Your audio thing of choice. I think it's best to just search my name, Sierra Cotto, and Funt to find it.
Get on that. Do it. And go to the website, which Sierra has coded herself.
Oh, yeah. SierraCotto.com.
Very cool.
See if that degree was worth it.
I did a little... You bet. Very expensive website.
You can find our website, which is...
Expensive website.
Which... I think Squarespace coded, and we altered. at probablyscience.com. You can find that. You can also find us on Twitter at probablyscience, individually at Jesse Case, at Andy T. Wooden, at Matt Kershen. And if you have any questions, comments, clarifications, stories you would like us to cover, you can go and email us, probablyscience@gmail.com. Also, if you go to probablyscience.com, as well as the links to the stories we talk about, you can also find our Patreon link. We're going to do an extra story for the Patreon patrons.
Mm-hmm.
And thanks for supporting the show, Patreon people. But also thanks for supporting the show and everyone who spreads the word and tells nice things about us to people. And let's, you know.
Yeah,
or bad things. Yeah, grabs thing
grabs your
press.
Parents' phone and forcibly downloads our podcast onto them and that kind of thing.
Yeah, let's inflate those numbers.
Let's do it. But go and check out Sierra. And listeners, we'll see you next time.
Bye.